So, to today's talk. We probably all know about open source software. There's plenty outside. We know about open source media, pictures, images, and also not that much, but still plenty of open source hardware. But today, John will talk about a very special kind of hard and software. That's medical devices. And they are something special, not so easy to create, and therefore there aren't that many. So John, I'm very curious, so give it up for John.
Thank you, everyone. So, as she mentioned, I'm here to talk about open source medical devices and some of where this is going to lead to on actually democratizing healthcare, making it more affordable, more accessible in things like Ukraine, which is battle-torn, in places like Africa and South America, where economy of scale and income just has meant traditional devices haven't been as readily available. And so we're going to go through what the challenges are today, and what we might be able to do to actually help make that a little easier for everyone. So for a little bit of background, I will be posting the slides to my GitHub afterwards and making sure that the talk gets up in the program gets updated with the link. I've spent my entire career in safety critical engineering. I was a board member of Biohacking Village from DEF CON. I am currently a senior principal security engineer at Medtronic and lead one of Medtronic's business units. And then I'm a diabetic with an insulin pump and CGM. I have been for over half my life, and I'm an active user of multiple open source medical devices, and both love those things and that they're open source, and hate the regulations that are making life worse for users. So, having now said that, I get to add, the opinions expressed are solely my own and do not express the views or opinions of my employer. As my employer is a large medical device manufacturer, I do have their permission to come speak. Due to we're talking about regulations and my personal feelings about some of them, I do have to add this disclaimer. So, I'm going to open up with what is a medical device? And now this is going to seem like a really dumb question, but there's a reason for it. So part of the reason I bring up what is a medical device, the European Commission is currently debating whether or not the EHR that stores hospital records is going to become a medical device next year. The UK just made any note transcription program that is used for recording medical notes a formal medical device. They just announced it. They didn't even give anybody any warning. And so the scope of what a medical device is getting weird, especially in the age of AI and other things, but in general, I think we all understand medical devices are used, whether it's a physical item or software, to treat, diagnose, and prevent health conditions, right? That could be a disease, that could be monitoring an injury, that could be correcting something like a brace because you've had an amputation. That could mean a million different things. Kind of the key, like gotchas on things that aren't a medical device, is if it doesn't have a well-defined intended use for a medical purpose. So, for example, your pedometer. Yes, it's great for your health, but it doesn't have an intended use specifically for treating a medical issue, and so is not a medical device. Similarly, pharmaceuticals fall under their own category, and we just generically say they're not medical devices. And when we do talk about medical devices, we kind of, in Europe, have three classes, but it's really four. The first class is everything from the thermometer you take your temperature with when you're sick, a wheelchair, a Band-Aid, kind of the scalpel, kind of those traditional, very simple mechanical systems. Next, we kind of move up to things like a syringe, a glucose meter, a headset or various things that can be plugged in that only cursory act or record information about someone, but do not invasively go inside them or do not directly perform treatment. And we kind of go to class 2B, where we have things like insulin pumps with automation, We have x-ray machines, we have other things that are directly providing treatment or hazardous material to you. And then we go to things like surgical robots, cardiac implants, and kind of the full scope up in class three. And so medical devices actually run the gamut. I will say, as of the moment, there are no open source medical devices that are in class three, but there are open source medical devices in classes 1, 2A, and 2B. And so they do actually have a lot more spread than we really would think about. So this flowchart is a useful item for people who are looking at later, but it's basically, how do I figure out when I'm making software whether this is a medical device or is this just healthcare software that I'm working on? Right? Like, A, first, is it software? Because if it's not medical device software, and then, like, is it in this particular list of items that have very specific things? Most of those are items like colored contact lenses, which don't treat anything medically, but have been deemed a medical device. And then we kind of go, does this provide treatment? Does this provide a diagnosis? And if those things follow, then you find out that you're under medical device regulations. And once you're under those regulations, life gets really tricky to be open source. So let's talk about what open source is. And I'm not here to start any fights, so I'm not putting a definition up on a slide that anyone's going to take my picture with or anything else. Right, I think we all know open source runs the gamut. When I talk about open source medical devices, I'm not just talking about that they have their source code that you can inspect and see, but more in the like free open source software perspective or free open source hardware perspective of, hey, you have access to this. You can go make a copy. You can use it. You can modify it. It's yours to do with as you please in the communities. And that kind of open source aspect is in turn something that we both all love and means that we can actually contribute to continuous improvement and make the world better, but also is where we run into the problem with our regulations. So next section is going to be really boring. I apologize. I'll answer questions afterwards. And like, if you got really bored to death, I'll buy you a beer. So regulations and guidance. And this is just a useful thing. So there's the International Medical Device Regulators Forum. This is a group of every regulator in the world who all get together and write down guidances that they're going to implement at a very high level. They have about 69 guidances. These are all high-level items that then get moved into local places like the EU, the US, Korea, Japan, who then adopt and write their own. Europe currently has 180-plus pages to print out and read the medical device regulation section. And Europe is considered to have one of the shortest set of medical device regulations of anywhere because Europe relies on standards so heavily. There are 120-plus guidance documents. Those total over 1,000 pages. And then we can talk about the US. The FDA Code of Regulations that applies to medical devices is 185,000-plus pages of A4 paper. So we're talking a lot of burden for knowing regulations and understanding what you can and can't do. There are 2,800-plus FDA guidances, and the FDA's guidances are getting longer. For something to put into perspective, in the early 2010s, the FDA released their first cybersecurity for medical device guidance. It was 13 pages. The most recent one that came out 2 years ago in 2023 was 80-plus pages, over four times as long. Now, the softer one, which had similar lifespans, it went up by about 15%. The cybersecurity one, huge increase. So when we talk about medical devices, we basically have a lot of rules we have to know and follow and they're expected to implement. And as the saying goes, regulations are written in blood. There's a reason every one of those rules is there. Almost every single one of them is tied to a patient who is seriously harmed, whose life was permanently altered or died. So I'm not saying I love that regulatory burden, but it is one of the challenges of an open source project having the people with enough knowledge and being able to maintain meeting that kind of burden. So let's kind of talk about what the burden is in general. We have a quality management system. Most of us here work from IT or security. ISO 9001 is going to be fairly familiar. Basically, ISO 9001 is a light version of what we have. We have a standard called ISO 13485. It's about three times as long for the standard. Activities are very similar. We have much higher levels of detail. When we talk about things like supplier evaluation or qualification, there are five pages or six pages devoted to the different things you have to do to monitor, evaluate, and qualify a supplier. We have a formal quality manual. So we have to define a lot of process that's fairly rigid process that we all have to follow. Now, yes, you can do it in an agile method. You can do it in a waterfall method. But going and creating all of those process documents, getting people trained, making sure everything follows that, ton of work. It's necessary work, but it is a high burden. And then we start talking about all of the standards we have to meet thanks to those wonderful guidances and such. There are things like 14971 that talks about risk management, where I have to go through and, for safety, do a design FME failure effect mode analysis. I have to do one for all of the production processes for manufacturing. Have to do threat modeling and risk analysis for security, and then translate all of those to the safety ones. I have to consider easily foreseeable misuse, i.e. not just what could go wrong in the product in general, but what stupid mistakes are my users going to make, and how do I prevent those? We have two standards for software, one for medical devices, one for health software. They're in the currently actually being merged, but we have to follow those. Those software safety pieces are very critical. I give classes on this at points. A key learning out of that software lifecycle that is always shocking to me is people talk about like third-party software and needing to be careful about supply chain software. We talk about off-the-shelf software, those things, and how we evaluate it. The software safety standard is written in blood. It came about because of three generations of a medical device built by the same company. In the course of that, they lost their records about what requirements or verification evidence they had. People thought they understood the design, but they didn't anymore, and they didn't have documentation. And that eventually led to the second generation, where they removed software interlocks because there were bugs and it was easier than fixing them. And then the third generation, where to save money, the company thought software interlocks were finally not buggy and removed the hardware interlocks, and patients got dosed with thousands of times the radiation they were supposed to. And we did not get the Incredible Hulk. We did not get Spider-Man. We, unfortunately, had a few accidents, and we have good, safe standards now. The last few years, we've brought in 80,000-1, so the standard for how do we safely and securely integrate to hospital and health delivery IT, and then 81,001-5-1, which is how do we do health software for the medical device manufacturers. What are you guys, what do my users actually expect me to do in the course of development and supporting this over its lifetime? We also have other standards like sterilization, on human use factors, and others. And so there's a fair number of standards. Now, each of these standards costs about 300 euros. So it's actually pretty expensive, and that's for a single user license. So it's actually pretty expensive to have a full copy of the standards you need to adhere to build an open source medical device. And lastly, the thing that is the most important part of medical devices, it's not designing them, it's not developing them, it's not manufacturing them, it's what you do once they enter the market. You actually need to do various activities. You have to do clinical reviews where we go, hey, is this still state of the art? Is this still the best performing or like adequate for meeting the needs of patients, right? Because some things like leeches, we don't use leeches really to treat people being sick anymore. That's not a thing. It's not state of the art, it's not clinically okay. Clinical review is how we make sure, even for more active devices, that we're always staying up to date with the best treatment options. Next are complaints. Anytime that something goes wrong with a medical procedure, that doctors actually have to file a formal, or are supposed to file a formal complaint and tell the manufacturer what happened. And the manufacturer has to investigate and figure out, like, was this a user error? Was this a design error? Was the error within the rate we expected? Similarly, we have to trend data from the field, both from complaints, from social media posts, from a million different things, to go, is our device safe and secure? Are the errors that are happening at the expected rates that we've set are acceptable, or are they exceeding that? We have to have a defined top management, just like your ISO 27001, to review all of that information and decide what adequate staffing, what training are needed, what changes or investments are needed. That leads to a safety report. These have to be filed every year with your regulators in the EU and the US. And then finally, a fun term, state of the art. Out of curiosity, show of hands, who thinks they know what state of the art means? All right, only a few people. So state of the art is a really weird thing in the ISO standard. State of the art is essentially the left half of the bell curve. It is from state of the technology, where something new is cool and published in academia and is just entering products, all the way through to where we're no longer called, like, until the end of it being able to be called good practice. So WPA is probably just leaving state of the art. I don't think anybody would call WPA state of the art in this room, but from a legal and ISO standard definition, that's where it falls. That being said, we do have to actually review our devices yearly for, does this still meet state of the art for the technology? Does it still meet state of the art for the clinical use case? And does it still meet state of the art for the standards and regulations? That's a lot of review work that we need to make sure happens. And again, challenging an open source project. So all of that sounds too hard. I don't want to discourage people. We're going to take a shortcut. And better yet, the regulators have approved this shortcut. They are actively endorsing it. We're going to just call it a reference design. So reference designs, and this gets crazy, we'll go over one in a few minutes, that was funded by Horizon Europe, who does new medical device innovation, was built by doctors, had large-scale clinical trials of 10,000-plus patients run on it. And the key item they did is they built all the evidence for everything you would need to go to a regulatory submission, and they stop right before you manufacture the product. And if you don't manufacture the product, it's just a reference design. And then you can hand that packet of information over to whoever manufactures the product. Now, hardware manufacturing, I think, all makes sense to us. The FDA and EU decided to create a nice little loophole on software manufacturing. If you don't compile the code and produce a compiled version, or you don't put a compiled version in an app store, it's not been manufactured yet. As such, it is only a reference design. Yay, loopholes! So, when we talk about reference designs, and we're going to go through some examples, the formal letter from the FDA on this is that they're going to treat a reference design when it's used by this, that a patient is voluntarily using, as an N equals one clinical trial. All that means is that a single patient has decided to perform a clinical trial on themselves with the device. That is how the FDA and EU have decided to interpret this to allow these things on the market and to exist. Is that great? Yes. I love open source. I love that they gave them a path forward. Is it adequate? I think we can do better, but we're going to go through that in a bit. So let's get physical. Who here loves hardware hacking? All right, few people, 3D printing? All right, so first up, from the Netherlands, since we're here in the Netherlands, the University of Twente developed a 3D printed brace. So if you've ever broken an ankle, one of the fun things they like to make you do is stand on your broken ankle for the x-ray. This is because your foot and muscles actually have to be held in traction for them to see certain kinds of fractures. Incredibly painful, incredibly bad for patients when you break both ankles because they can't actually get the x-ray. And so in combination with some orthopedic nurses and the development students at the university, they figured out how to build a 3D printed brace that can hold a foot in the correct position in traction using ratchet straps. And now the patient can stay laying down or could be unconscious and get the x-ray that's needed to figure out their clinical care. This is awesome. This is, again, technically a reference design. This is not quite a medical device. Now, I give the University of Twente credit. They actually developed it enough that, and got their QMS certified, followed all the standards, but because they can't accept the overhead and burden for post-market surveillance, because they want it to be open source so that anyone in any country can freely print it, we are again in reference design territory. Still awesome. So 3D printed prosthetics, commonly used throughout the world. There are at least 20 different organizations I'm aware of that 3D print these things for everyone from people in war zones, people in low income areas, because every amputation is going to be slightly different on the end. People are different heights. The design is very generic to start with, and then you have to customize to your user's height, to your user's profile, right? If you're making an orthopedic for a leg and that has some kind of articulated foot, like what someone who is 6 foot pound, or six, what someone who is 180 centimeters tall and 120 kilograms is very different than what someone 120 centimeters at 50 kilograms needs. So again, we call it a reference design. We allow open access, and we're improving people's lives. More interesting, in a weird way, I know we all talk about the problems that we have with outsourcing to Asia and the economy of scale for cheap goods that come from there and the trash it can create. Texas Instruments actually did something really interesting in the early to mid-2000s. They built over 500 plus reference medical devices. These are devices where it can be anything from two-thirds of a product to 99.9% of a product. Full circuit board schematics, software for some of them, full performance and specifications, full design package that shows it was developed with the right QMS thoughts. Now, why did TI do this? Out of the goodness of their heart? Maybe a little bit. For customers. This makes it very easy to pick something up and go finish the design yourself. Or say that you're building a surgical robot that needs an infusion pump as part of one of its operations. You can go take TI's reference design and you don't have to build an infusion pump yourself. You have all the requirements, you have all the testing. They actually got it, all of those things, if you buy the TI branded parts that have gone through supplier qualification, certified, so that you can off the shelf use it in your device with no extra work. This has actually led to a different interesting problem. Some of you may be aware, earlier this year, there was a problem with a contact patient monitor. For those who don't know, this is monitors in the hospital that connect and monitor your vitals, connect back to a central monitoring point. So if you start to code, if your blood pressure goes too low, your heart rate goes too high, nurses are notified. So Contech didn't actually design that part. It's a different company in China. There are actually 218 different companies who have registered versions of that because it's all the same reference design, and the final manufacture was performed by a different company, and then it's white labeled into whatever brand we want to sell it as. Still a really interesting use of open source hardware, and TI actually, all of those reference designs for medical devices actually are with the traditional free as in freedom, go use these however you want kind of licensing, which is abnormal for commercial, but great for us, and works out well for TI on the people who are commercially using it. Interesting use case, if you're ever interested in like trying to incorporate an ECG sensor, biofeedback sensors, or anything else into a Raspberry Pi device, they have a reference circuit for you. They will tell you all the parts you need, they will tell you how well it performs, they will even point you at the right software to run it. And I apologize, I'm bad at remembering names, but I did want to have this shout out. So at May Contain Hackers, we ran, myself along with Zcert, ran the first Hack the Health Village, and someone from Italy actually brought a ventilator that their hackerspace built during COVID and that got used in the hospital. They came up with the innovation that between 3D printing and scuba parts that were readily available, that they could actually help make sure there was enough ventilation for the patients at the hospital during COVID when they couldn't buy ventilators, they couldn't borrow, beg, or steal them. And so, right, this is what the good the community can do. It is an example of a physical hardware device that can actually help save someone's life and keep their life sustained. But I think some of us here, getting physical is great, but we like to code, so we'll talk about a software project or two. So the first one we can talk about is a product called Night Scout. Anyone who has diabetes has probably heard of this. Night Scout was built by parents. The parents had one simple need. Their child had diabetes. Their child got a continuous glucose sensor, and at that time, that sensor could only show the glucose reading on the actual small screen device that had to stay within about 10, 15 feet, within 3 to 5 meters of the patient. And so they wanted to have a secondary screen with that information. They reverse engineered the protocol that the data comes off of and then built it so that basically you can go run your own private cloud. I don't have to agree with whatever brand medical device I have. I actually have a glucose sensor on my arm here. I can connect that to my phone, I can have it in the cloud, I can choose who that data gets shared with, and I can have full control of my medical data and be able to share it so that for parents of diabetics that they can see their child's glucose so that, like, if it goes low in the middle of the night and the kid doesn't wake up from the alarm, that they can be woken up and make sure that they're okay. This has a lot of great use cases, and it's a great example of what the community can accomplish. It is completely custom code written by the community to help support a well-defined need. More interesting than just Night Scout, but Night Scout came first, so it goes first, is the Open Artificial Pancreas System, also known as Open APS, and the next generation of it that is called Android APS. This actually got funded by Horizon Europe. Europe spent millions of dollars to support the creation of this open source medical product. The idea here was that as diabetics, we were tired of waiting. In traditional diabetes, it started where years ago you would pee on a stick and take insulin based on that very large range. And then we got to finger meters and being able to take insulin more routinely. And then we got to insulin pumps where we still could have background insulin given to us, but we had to manually check our blood and we have to enter how many carbs we eat each time. The idea of a hybrid or a closed loop system is that you no longer have to interact with your insulin pump. Your insulin pump is going to detect the trends and things happening with your blood sugar and going to adjust accordingly. Awesome, life-changing, especially for people with ADD or ADHD or who just get distracted in the middle of a task sometimes. You go to enter your blood sugar, you go, how many carbs was that? Your phone rings, and an hour later, your blood sugar is too high. Or at least that's me. And so this literally was life-saving and life-changing technology. We knew that there were algorithms that worked because in hospital, closed-case clinical trials in a hospital bed, those algorithms had been developed. They had been shown to be successful. But it took a week in a hospital setting to prove that. That obviously, you don't want to be stuck in a hospital your whole life, and medical device manufacturers were taking a while to get through clinical trials and get there, and even once they did, there's no guarantee that the algorithm that works best for you is what was going to come on the insulin pump, or the one that, for the US, your insurance approves, for Europe, that your insurance or national healthcare provider may have for your choices. And so they actually built this. This is a full closed loop system. It takes in data from a glucose sensor, and then it can control your therapy. So for a diabetic, you still can't go drink full sugar Coke, but you can go out throughout your entire day. I have gone for multiple days with not ever having to touch my insulin pump or think about it or my glucose meter and stayed in perfect range. Life-changing, life-altering, amazing. But those problems that I talked about, it's still reference design. It's still treated as a clinical trial of one. And so I'm going to go with a quote from Marcus Cicero. If we desire respect for the law, we must first make the law respectable. So they gave us a loophole. And that's great. It got the door open. But if we back up for a second, how many people here are concerned about software supply chain vulnerabilities? Right? How many times have we seen repository confusion attacks? How many times has a lazy user in your group, instead of putting in an IT ticket, just searched on Google to go download something? Right? So life-changing therapy that's awesome, that in the US is endorsed by the American Diabetes Association. In the Netherlands Diabetes Association actively endorses both projects that I brought up. They actively encourage you to talk to your doctor about using them and say that they are safe, reliable clinical therapy. Right? So the clinical experts that I rely on are saying this is safe, reliable, I can go use it. How many people like having to compile and build code or run into issues when you go and download stuff off of GitHub and it takes 3 hours to get the right compiler, the right Python library versions and everything else? And now we're suggesting users that are not that technical can go do this and it's safe and reliable, that they're not just going to search for Night Scout or OpenAPS APK and click the very first link that may be anything and download it. And right, these aren't corporate managed devices. This is bring your own device. This is your personal cell phone. Like, this is a problem. It is great that they opened the door. It is great that they actually care about cybersecurity, that under NIS2, we have become critical infrastructure in healthcare, and that everyone actually has to do appropriate security risk management and up their game. These are amazing steps forward for all of us. And yet they open the door and now kind of completely ignore the security aspects that are still going to be a challenge. And things like complaints. And I'm not saying that either of those projects has an issue. They are supported by hundreds of committed developers and clinicians. There's a team of medical safety clinicians for the current Android APS who donate their time and review every user-submitted bug to look at it for safety issues. That is amazing. That is not where most open-source software things end up. But is it really okay that we're saying, like, oh, well, to avoid the regulation that brings in items that we know you can't meet, we're going to go ahead and say that we should just ignore things, that we should go, hey, like, you can't meet the regulation, we won't allow you to exist, we're gonna cut a corner. I don't know, I think that we can do better. I think that there are more viable roads. And more importantly, I think as we progress in the future, this is gonna become a bigger deal. So, digital twins and virtual human twins. Subject near and dear to my heart, as it's what my PhD that I'm currently pursuing is around. Right, this digital twins, for those who don't know, are about creating a emulated, simulated version of a device product ecosystem. The idea that your circulatory system, your pancreatic system, you can go model that because we have enough data and computing power. The idea for a virtual human twin is that we string enough of those together and we can predict what happens for a human being. We can choose what is the best form of treatment, what is the right choices. But AI and machine learning advance at incredibly fast paces. And those advancements are made in commercial spaces, but equally from academia. Right now, academia is leading the way in medicine. How do we ensure that we're actually staying on pace for that state of the art? How do we make sure that the hospital or the insurance who choose to integrate all these different digital twins are actually going to understand that compound risk, that they're actually going to look back at how those interactions play out? And why should we say just because something is made by a giant commercial company that is inherently better than the academic model that went through the same form of clinical trials and like volumes of patient data? Like, how do we make sure this works? I think it's the same problem. Open source and the limitation there is shutting down our ability to kind of adopt academic approaches and like allow that playing field to be a little more level. So the question I put to all of you, is change possible? I think the answer is yes. I do think so. The European Commission has actually opened numerous comment, like requests for comments. There are national level requests for comments for what do you want to see change? What do you want to enable? Like, there is an opportunity here to help push for the kind of changes that would allow open source, right? There are things that we've seen in the open source community, such as OSI or the Open Source Foundation, adopting projects when they get large enough to make sure that they have that infrastructure for continued support to make things happen, right? The things that are stopping us, cost, paperwork burden, regulatory burden, as OpenAPS shows, as Night Scout shows, they actually found ways to get around that. They built that burden. TI showed that like there is a way and a path forward to do this at scale for rigid structure and expectations. So the problems really become, how do we make sure that when there are bugs, that someone is appropriately looking at those in a timely fashion, that someone's monitoring, is the software still doing well? And like that we go and fix things. And I think those are problems that open source has actually traditionally solved versus commercial products where support got abandoned. Like, this is actually what open source has done well for us. The real question is, how do we get the regulators to kind of help us take that step forward? So, last thing before I open the floor for questions, I will mention immediately following this, the Healthcare Hacking Village is doing a threat modeling workshop. So we are actually going to threat model Android APS, which right now has one mention of the word security in its entire 400 pages of documentation for users. It's got 2,000 different security or safety issues and different things for users to consider around that. One mention of the word security and not about the risks that it currently poses. So we're going to make a threat model. We're going to go commit back to the open source project and help them take a step forward in making sure that their users are informed of the risks and kind of understand what's going on. And at that, I will open the floor to questions. As I said, my presentation will be on GitHub, and there are numerous resource links if you want to get involved for 20 different projects in the open source community, everything from 3D printing to electronics to software.
Okay, so thanks, excellent. I was fascinated. Many new things for me too. So I take a look at the back. Do we have any questions from the internet? Not yet, or no? So any questions from the audience? Then just, should I step back better? Thanks. Just go to the microphone. We have a first question.
Yes, I was wondering, I'm working on a machine which is going to be IVDR. So in vitro diagnosis, is there anything very different from what you presented for that field, do you know?
No, so the regulations for IVDR and medical devices are incredibly similar. IVDR is very similar to class 2 medical devices, which basically is a much lighter-handed touch because you don't directly harm the patient. A doctor may make decisions based on that. That said, there's still plenty of great security issues or other things we've learned. For example, that the NHS got shut down and thousands of surgeries had to be canceled and rescheduled for weeks because an IVDR testing facility got taken over with malware. So nothing too different, same concerns, just a little bit less risk of patient harm, which actually opens the door a little wider for open source.
Thank you.
Yep.
So what are your thoughts on reverse engineering existing devices to add new functionality? For instance, the second sight retinas that have been discontinued and users now need to be able to hack their own retinas, or things like the ResMed CPAP machines that are this, with firmware updates could be turned into BiPAP or ventilators without having to acquire new hardware or to purchase those upgrades?
So that's a difficult question for me to answer, A, because my employer has asked me not to answer those kind of things directly for my opinion on a stage. B, the real key about that comes down to a key part of the regulation about intended use. You're expanding the intended use. And I'm okay with the expansion of intended use, right? That's what the artificial pancreas system that I brought up for the insulin pump is. It's an expansion of an intended use to go to a closed loop system. That said, with that, you have to have someone who has the experience for clinical evaluation of, does this still actually meet the performance need that we need to have for that change? And from a personal feeling, it's very mixed. I really, really hope that as medical device manufacturers, we are securing and locking things down well enough that hackers aren't able to. On an e-waste and when devices are discontinued perspective, I fully understand. There's a really interesting case study on this very idea that came out of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, based on India, where due to a parts issue and discontinuation, they actually saw hackers come together to reverse engineer how a TPM mechanism worked so they could swap parts between existing machines to create one working machine out of two broken ones to reverse engineer that mechanism that was locking configuration. So it's not unprecedented. Personal feelings, as long as it's being done with the right clinical safety, I'm for it. That said, like, I also am for us securing devices well enough that a bad attacker couldn't do the same.
Thank you.
So if there aren't any questions right now, I actually have one.
Okay.
Because in the beginning, you mentioned standards. And
yep.
Back then, when I found out that standards are actually pretty expensive, like you mentioned, I thought, why do I have to pay for standards to look at them when I have to follow them like a law? So maybe you have an official or a private answer for that. What are your thoughts on that?
So standards are an interesting issue. I will say that for those of us in the EU, the standards have to be available in a set number of languages, regardless of which country you're in. Based on general economic conditions, looking at the Estonian standards organizations can be very affordable for obtaining standards at low, low costs compared to Western Europe. This is actually an interesting issue in not applicable to medical devices, but in consumer products. There actually was a recent EU court ruling that says if a product has to meet a standard and that standard is presented to the user has a legal right to a free copy of the standard. And most of the standards that we're talking about, they both exist at the ISO level. And then Senelec, who does the localization for Europe, actually will adopt a version of it for Europe. Often it's word for word the same. And those can be more readily accessible, including through like Netherlands public libraries, for example. If you were looking for a copy, just review. There are limitations on commercial use, so buyer beware and read your licensing.
Okay, thanks. So, any more questions? Maybe online? No?
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, and feel free to come up and talk after.